Welcome to episode 63. Bear with me this week as we are at the point in the journey at Malmstrom Air Force Base when the world changed in so many ways because of the attack on the United States homeland. Of course, I'm referring to September 11th, 2001. I shared a bit about this day in a very short episode, number 6, as a special episode, and I'm going to adapt part of that which was released more than a year ago. In addition, I'll be adding some new thoughts and experiences as well. Throughout history, there are events that happen that most remember where they were in that point in time when they heard the news. Examples like when President Kennedy was assassinated, this NASA ship Challenger exploded, and terrorism took down the Murrah Building in Oklahoma, and of course, September 11th, 2001. It was a Tuesday morning before the duty day started for the majority of the staff in my building. I was in the office, and I was usually in just before 6. As the commander, my office was the only one with a TV in it, and just before 7, local time in Montana, one of the sergeants from downstairs ran into my office where I was in an informal discussion with two others on a topic I certainly don't recall. The first reaction is, "Why are you interrupting our meeting?" After a quick pause, he said, "Sir, turn on your TV." "What? Turn on my TV? We're in a meeting." He repeated, saying, "Sir, turn on your TV," and clearly there was some urgency in his voice. What we saw was unimaginable. As the images of the first plane into the World Trade Center unfolded, the word spread to the building, and my office became the hub very quickly. We are watching and listening, stunned, like the rest of the nation. There was a loop where they repeated showing the plane crashing into the World Trade Center. And then, as it looked like they were repeating it again, I said, "No, wait, that is a different building." And it was the second plane. And just then, the announcer exclaimed, "This is a second plane." The office fell quiet, and we were absorbing the events as they unfolded. About this time, I took the opportunity to talk about implications for the Pentagon and administration, having been assigned there 2 tours earlier, and going to Malmstrom from teaching national security strategy at the University of Texas at Austin. I reminded the team that there had been much smaller attacks by terrorist groups in the past, including the World Trade Center in 1993. What terrorists had not done in the past is to coordinate an attack in another major city at the same time. And it was just about a minute or so later, the announcement of the crash into the Pentagon was broadcast. My colleagues stared at me because they're wondering, "Why did you just say that and it happened?" And then by the time the plane crashed in Pennsylvania, that was reported en route to Washington, D.C., we were all wondering what was happening and, more importantly, what was next. Now remember the mission of the 341st Mission Wing. As one of the 3 U.S. Air Force bases that maintains and operates the Minuteman III intercontinental ballistic missiles, while these events are unfolding on the East Coast, you can imagine that our base was already on high alert and the base was locked down. The base gates were already backed up, and people were wondering what was going on since they were en route to work, and if they didn't have their radio on, they had no idea what was happening. Leaving the base was not an option for those that lived on base, and the school where the base children went was also locked down, which was not too far outside the base. It was some time before parents could go retrieve their children, which I'm sure was extremely stressful. By now, you also know that Air Force Services is responsible for mortuary affairs, and with that, we had the most experience with mass casualties. From a civilian perspective, you may have remembered that it was Air Force Mortuary that handled the crash of Secretary Ron Brown's plane from Dover Air Force Base in Delaware that I described when I was at the Pentagon. And more recently, during the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, images on TV showed the fallen military members were brought first to Dover Air Force Base for dignified processing. The Dover Port Mortuary falls under the auspices of the Air Force Services Agency in San Antonio, and you may remember the news shots of the airspace over the United States. They showed pictures of all the planes flying wherever they're going across the nation. And then they showed the screen where the airspace was completely empty. One plane did fly from San Antonio to Washington, D.C. that day. The plane carrying the Director of Mortuary Affairs to Washington, D.C., because his expertise was sorely needed. I also made a call to the air staff as well and told Mr. Myers that if needed, I was also willing to assist. Back at Malmstrom, with all these changes on the fly, we had long lines outside the gate in the mornings to get onto the base for those who lived off-base like I did. The security police commander was concerned because this long line was viewed as a potential target. The cars had no place to go. I don't recall how long the base was locked down. It was a fair amount of time. The news eventually stopped showing the planes crashing into the towers in the Pentagon because it was affecting people with a reality that was so uncommon to our nation. And the repeated images of the planes crashing into the buildings was very challenging for so many people. I remember that when the lockdown was lifted at Malmstrom, a fellow commander shared a story with me. They were getting ready to drive off the base for the first time, and one of their young children started screaming and crying, and he told his dad to stop. He did stop the vehicle and tried to ascertain what was going on. What they learned was that because the young child saw the images on TV over and over, he thought that it was right outside the base and knew that he was safe on base and was scared. I remember how that impacted my own lens as a person who doesn't have children and the impact on seeing the images on TV over and over. Today, with the current conflicts in Ukraine and now Israel, these images are likely having somewhat a similar effect on adults and children. Even when there have been tragic shootings in schools, and I wonder what that impact has had on America's children, and that must be frightening to be sure. This event just didn't affect America and changes in the United States. Around the world, there were changes, especially among our allies. Having traveled to 18% of the world, from Sydney to London, Cape Town to Tokyo, you can see the impact even today from 9/11. Up until about 2016 or so, when traveling from Europe back to the United States, you would go through two sets of security, one for the host nation and one run by TSA. And once you went through that second security line, you could no longer walk back into the airport. Along came global entry and trusted traveler programs in the United States and other nations over time to recognize well-vetted citizens, which I'm happy that that process started. As you know, a lot has changed as a result of 9/11 in civilian life, for sure. The creation of Homeland Security, the largest constellation of government agencies in a lifetime, TSA, rules for traveling, and so forth. There were major changes for military security as well. During this period, I remember that we were told to tape over our vehicle stickers that showed we were driving a registered vehicle onto the base. As a side note, these stickers are now long gone. The stickers had a big strip that said that it was a DOD vehicle, and underneath the sticker was the important part for many of us. It designated your status. Junior enlisted members had a red stripe, NCOs a gold one, and officers had a blue strip underneath the main sticker. Civilians had a green strip. Now, eventually, when these went away, also what went away was that colonels and general officers also had their rank alongside the sticker as well, and so you knew who the senior leaders were. Growing up in the military, changing your sticker color was in some ways a badge of progress. And this time, it was a target of possible terrorism, because when you're off base, anyone could tell a vehicle that was owned by a different level of an active duty member. Bases were relatively easy to enter back then, and that also changed to 100% ID check, even today, for the driver and the passenger of all the vehicles that go on base. I live close to a base where I go shopping, and now even the civilians that are in the vehicle, the ID check is not just checking their ID. They actually have to go in and get a physical card for the duration that they're going to be visiting the base. And so these changes continue to ramp up even today. I remember vividly living in what can easily be considered a typical American community. As one drove down the streets of Great Falls, nearly every single home and business was flying the American flag, and some more than one. There were flags on the lawns, flags draped on buildings, and a sense of patriotism was clear. The country became united very quickly, and we are all Americans. I remember seeing news shots similarly across the country, as well of what I saw in Great Falls. It has been more than two decades, and there are young adults today that didn't live through 9/11. I was watching professional football this past weekend, and the quarterback for the New York Jets was just 2 years old on 9/11. Looking at data from 2021, 28.6% of the population wasn't born by 2001 in the United States. I don't have a lot of answers and still have a lot of questions. My greatest concern is one that is playing out in some measure now. The doctrine of the United States was to be able to engage with two major regional conflicts, or MRCs, and two smaller conflicts called regional conflicts, and the further we move from 2001, the more what seems to be complacent we become as a nation and global community, and we cannot allow that to be the new normal. Let me thank you for letting me share my own thoughts about 9/11. On a personal positive note, there is some good news. I competed for and was selected for Lieutenant Colonel, and that's a very good thing. My office celebrated by decorating my office, and since my date of commission is January, I'll be on the forward end of when the promotions start, and yet it always is a bit of time. The neat thing is that once an officer makes major and above, each list has to be approved by Congress. Except for very senior officers, it's really a pro forma event, yet you are listed in the congressional record. Once you make major, you have to be a regular officer, which is another process that you go through, well, you went through then as a captain. Most officers like me competed for and were selected for regular early on, and then you are an officer of the military and an officer of the United States. For this promotion, the Congressional Record is Volume 148, Number 18, and my name is on page 1,325. Since I knew it would be months before I would pin on Lieutenant Colonel, I would be at my next assignment, knowing my tenure at Malmstrom was well into the second year. Command does go pretty fast, especially as busy as we were. Being the commander has lots of advantages, to be sure. I also had some drawbacks, especially when there was a kerfuffle, and not just any kerfuffle, a kerfuffle involving the wing commander. The commander was in the fitness center, and on returning to his office, his secretary calls me and says that I am to report to the wing commander with the person who is responsible for the fitness center towels immediately. Okay, this is not a good scenario. I am to report to the wing commander? I haven't reported to a senior officer since officer training school. I quickly call in the flight chief and ask what's going on. I get a two-sentence possible scenario and rush out of the office. It's a quick walk to the wing building, and I'm still half running. I get to the office, and the secretary says to report in. Hoping to remember the procedure, I walk in, stand in front of his desk, salute, and report. He does not return the salute right away, and that's also not a good sign. Eventually, he does, and I know I'm likely to stand at attention, and he says, I told you to bring the person in charge of the towels at the fitness center. I said, sir, I would never bring the person with me to report to you. I'm the commander and take full responsibility for my unit. He pauses, and eventually he says to take a seat. He is calming down and tells me his perspective of what happened. To make a long story short, it was a major miscommunication in the organization, and I get out of the office with most of my body parts. I call the flight chief back into my office, and all I say is, I am not going to do that again. Luckily, with the reputation that was built as a squadron, it passed over pretty quickly. My boss and I had a long conversation as well, and the salient point that came out of that conversation was that I did the absolute right thing by going alone. Another issue that often occurs in a services squadron is there will be, likely, an alleged issue of child abuse. When this occurs, most of you likely know that it has to be reported immediately to a number of places, and that did occur during my tenure. Fortunately, it was not child abuse, and at the same time, there is a bit of urgency in getting the issue resolved in a professional and immediate manner. As I said last week or 2 weeks ago, being the commander is not always unicorns and rainbows. Trying to be as measured as possible when these things happen is really important, and that's where the balance with my deputy worked out well, because he both had a more measured approach than I often did, and he was also so well connected inside and outside of the unit that issues like this were resolved fairly quickly. And I know he took care of a lot of the issues that occurred in the unit, because all of the flights except for the combat support flight fell under his immediate responsibility. Stepping into the Wayback Machine, remember my time at Red Horse with field exercises and then as the career field manager and my visit to the training area with that young airman who was washing pots and pans in a field exercise as part of services technical training. We train our services personnel for our wartime mission and we do exercises throughout the year at every base. I have to caveat that I'm telling you how it was then because, of course, there's no way for me to know how the wartime manning is designed today. For bases like Malmstrom, when there is a need to deploy Air Force troops, like what happened after 9/11 with the start of Desert Storm and subsequently what was known as the Gulf War, our wing doesn't deploy because the wartime mission is on our base and missile fields compared to flying squadrons that deploy to a forward location. Our enlisted and officer services personnel are identified to augment deploying squadrons. We get the tasking order to deploy some of our services enlisted personnel to support the wartime food, lodging, and recreation missions. We deployed about a dozen or so of our troops. The rest of the enlisted personnel remaining at Malmstrom had to work extended shifts as well because we still had the mission here at home. Some were aligned as Lieutenant Thomas found necessary. As a commander, sending your personnel on real-world deployments is both organizationally challenging and personally concerning. This reminds me of a story that occurred with a conversation with my friend Ken Bryson, who you heard from earlier in the podcast. By this time, he was at Lackland Air Force Base serving as a squadron training officer. Just as it was when I was there all those years ago, when trainees get their job assignments, they sometimes get what they want and sometimes get jobs in the best interest of the Air Force, which means that you don't get what you want. He said that when an airman would learn they were going into services, there was a bit of a letdown compared to, say, security forces, aircraft maintenance, or another operational career field. Of course, he knew what services did and asked me what he could tell the airmen to give a boost to learning that they were going into services. After all, the word services is certainly less descriptive than almost every other career field in the Air Force. Well, that's easy. Tell them that services has a wartime mission that is critical to the Air Force. Without services, there are no hot meals. Without services, there is no lodging for troops. And without services, there is no fitness or recreation programs to keep our troops fit and to let off steam. I told him to have them imagine what would the mission look like if troops had no meals or a place to sleep. He said that once he clarified the services mission, others would raise their hands and ask if their career field was important too. It really made me smile and emphasizes that every job is important. Like the airmen cleaning pots and pans in the field, no job is more important at that point in time. Now, I'll tell you that when I was a young airman, working the grill for breakfast in the wee hours of the mornings, it sometimes didn't feel like it was very important. Someone would yell at you the eggs didn't come out over easy, or you didn't fix something the way that they asked, and you went home smelling like the grill, or like that young woman when I would be on a field exercise lighting those immersion heaters and field cooking burners that are very dangerous. You're thinking, this is not really fun. Alas, and then if you really thought about it, your squadron mates would leave the dining facility and go work on the operational part of the squadron mission. And without that breakfast, well, we all know that was an important job. You'll also remember that when I briefed new people into the squadron, I told them that when they're doing their job at that time, they are more important than the commander, because that part of the mission is so very important. It's coming to the point in my assignment that I'm looking at what am I going to do after my tour as commander. One option in my mind was to go back to the Air Staff. Commanders in services often rotate from command to a staff assignment or to school, although some do go from command, one command to another. More senior commanders often go into and compete for a deputy group command position. At this point, I'm at 23 years of service, well past the ability to retire. I'm reminded of General Leasy's advice as he retired, and still, now that I have a line number for Lieutenant Colonel, I will have a service obligation for a couple of years before I can retire at that grade. So it's definitely at least one more assignment. What happens next is both a real surprise and at the same time an opportunity that opens so many more doors, like often happens with the Air Force. There really is no bad assignment. By this point, we have a number of challenges going on. We have many more mortuary cases, deployed personnel, and I'm addressing a couple of squadron personnel issues as well. We have turnover in some of our facility managers and the typical changes in military personnel due to reassignments. Of these, one of the most significant is the first sergeant. It's really a critical position for a commander, and because it was services and I didn't have a large number of enlisted personnel, I wouldn't always get a officially trained first sergeant, and that sometimes was a little bit of a challenge. I mentioned that their main job is to advise the commander and be the spokesperson as well for the enlisted advisor and mentor to the NCOs in the unit. I would say that while each was very different in their approach, they were all exceptional NCOs, and I was very fortunate to have talented leaders. In services, the first sergeant also has a unique additional responsibility. And while I say responsibility, it's perhaps more accurately described as the role of defender. At first sergeant meetings, there inevitably would be complaints about a facility or a policy, and they had to shoulder this different than, say, other first sergeants. It was a good conduit of feedback to the squadron, and in hindsight, between the first sergeant's information gathering, both direct and indirect, and the credibility of the deputy commander and his information gathering system, I had both positive and negative feedback loops that helped shape my thinking, and I'll go more into that next week. As I end the week, I found a photo that I knew I had and I wanted to post earlier in the podcast, and I finally found it. It's a photo of the headstone of my maternal great-grandfather, who you know I was named after. Remember that his name was Henry Thomas Holton, and I was initially named Thomas Henry Terwilliger. So being named after him, it was also a good play on initials, his being HTH and mine being THT. I'm posting that photo in this week's episode photos. He is buried alongside his parents, most likely because he died at a relatively early age, and my grandfather's mom lived to 100 years old. With that, have a great week. Next week, I plan to finish up the assignment at Malmstrom Air Force Base and share what comes next.